forever.
Dog. Welcome to Public Intellectual. Public Intellectual is a podcast supported by its listeners. So if you'd like to see this podcast continue into the future, go to patreon.com/publicintellectual. We've spoken in various episodes of this podcast about how things like housing and city planning are feminist issues, how traditional setups of American cities and also the traditional sort of nuclear family household reinforces these very traditional domestic roles, and that to escape these roles for both genders, it is necessary to rethink how we occupy buildings, how we occupy houses, how we occupy cities, and to imagine new ways of creating and sharing domesticity rather than what we're doing right now, which is to escape enforced domesticity as women simply by making enough money to make some other woman do it for us, whether that be the woman at Grubhub who's making our food or the woman at the laundromat cleaning our clothes or whoever. And it takes a different kind of imagination and also a different kind of desire to build these new systems. It's complicated. And I've written about these issues repeatedly, and I've always gotten such a passionate response because it seems like people are fed up with the way that apartment buildings, rent, houses, marriages are expected to be lived in, and they want alternatives. And there are very few alternatives these days. So I invited an urban planner to speak with me about this subject so that we could devote an entire episode. And so I asked Dorina Pojani to come and speak about urban planning. She is a professor at the University of Queensland. And we talk about how we can begin to think about bringing feminism into urban planning on a much larger scale. It's funny to me how issues about urban planning and how cities and domestic spaces are laid out have completely, almost completely, I guess not completely because we are, you and I are talking about this today, but have fallen off the kind of feminist radar. And there has been this long history of women writing about urban spaces and domestic spaces and so on, as being an integral part of women's liberation. And so so that's what I want to talk to you about today, is how urban planning is a feminist issue. So how has that idea, how did you come upon it, and sort of how do you think about it in the contemporary world?
Well, it's interesting to me that you say that. It's true that I myself did not receive any education whatsoever when I was in school about feminist urban planning. I came upon it later doing my own reading. Some of the early writers like Dolores Hayden kind of opened my eyes to the issue. But there is a little bit of writing can change in books by early feminists like Betty Friedan, talked a little bit about how house layouts are designed and how these modern houses at the time when she was writing in the 60s were these open spaces were being pushed. She saw those as not being very friendly to women because the one space that women had, the kitchen, that was their space, now was becoming a communal space. And that's where women did the cooking. But then sometimes they also did their work. And she talks about how she often had her typewriter on the kitchen counter. And so that doubled as her workspace. And now with these open spaces that was taken away from many women. So that's how I sort of connected the dots, doing bits of reading here and there. But it's very true that these issues are not very well known. And when I've done some writing now in 2017-18, I've received all this backlash. I mean, that was very, very surprising to me. And the comments that I received on my own writing, they seem to be completely divided along gender lines. And my first reaction was surprise, because I didn't think the stuff I was talking about, the city needing to be better designed for women, I didn't think it was such a controversial idea, but it seems like it still is in the 21st century.
Yeah, that's bizarre. What were some of the comments about, I guess, negative to your position? Like, what kind of criticism were you receiving? And I'm assuming you were receiving them from men.
Yes. Well, it's yes. And women were being supportive. So both sides, it seemed as if what I wrote had sort of ignited these gender wars, and that was not my intention at all. So what a lot of men were saying was that, well, the city is not very well designed for men either. And that's very true. I mean, that's definitely true. A lot of men have a hard time moving around, and that also depends on where the men stand in the socioeconomic scale. For example, if you have a rich woman, she's probably better placed to be able to move around. She'll have a car. If it's someone ultra rich in the West or someone middle class in a developing country, she might even have a chauffeur to move her around. And so she'll definitely do much better in terms of urban planning and accessibility than a man in the same setting who is poor. So there is that for sure. I recognize that. It's more what I'm saying, all else being equal, women have it harder in the city because of our lifestyles. I mean, the need to take care of the house and of the family, which is definitely, I mean, we know from research that it's definitely women's burden still. Women still do more than half of household tasks. That's a fact. There is no question about it.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, like a lot of problems with contemporary feminism, which tends to think of things on a level of individual freedom, you know, what could make my life better rather than, you know, sort of everyone's life better. It seems like the shift happened once you could sort of buy your way out of domestic responsibility. So once you were able to, you know, once women had enough access to enough money in order to pay people to do their laundry and, you know, cook their meals, and not just in the sense of, you know, like the being so wealthy you have a personal chef, but just in the sense of, like, you know, using Grubhub or Seamless and having someone bring you tacos in the middle of the night. Once women could afford that, like, these things became less urgent. But it does seem like, you know, when you sort of read both early 20th century and sort of second wave feminist, materialist feminist is the term that Adelaide Haydon referred to them as, it would make everybody's lives easier, not just women's lives, but men's lives easier as well, if we took on these ideas of sort of, well, one of them being shared domesticity and socialized domesticity. So when you're talking about urban planning, it's not just about, like, you know, where zoning laws come into play and where grocery stores are. It's really about how we organize the house too, and the domestic space, right?
Yes. Well, definitely. And so I wanted to react to a few things that you said. So a lot of women in the West, you know, if they're in a social position, say middle class and above, they're able to outsource domestic tasks to others, but that often means hiring a poor woman to do their household tasks for them, right? So hiring a poor nanny, often a migrant, hiring a gardener, all of that. And that begs the question, I mean, so how about the nanny's own life? You know, how about her children? She's probably leaving her own children at home with no care. She's having to travel for hours to that job to take care of your children. So in the end, if everyone fixes their own problem individually, I don't know that as a society we've fixed the problem. That's one issue. And then looking at the statistics, it's interesting that among developed countries, it seems like the US is one of the few that is still having positive birth rates. So people are still having lots of children, even accounting for, you know, the fact that there are migrants in the US, but also among the middle classes, people are having the white middle classes. People seem to be having more children. So professional women are still having children. And that's not been the case for a long time in places like Germany, Japan, Italy. Women seem to have just completely given up on that. They've said, until the governments sort of take care of our needs, provide us with childcare, healthcare, easy transport, we're just not going to do it. That's too big a burden, to the double burden of taking care of the family and holding on a job, being a productive member of society that way. And I think the reason in America people will still do it is because everyone seems to have bought into this idea that your family is your personal responsibility. It doesn't matter how the city is laid out. The city is laid out in some sort of natural way, though it's not natural. It's planning decisions that produce cities. But whatever that is, we don't have the power to change that. All we can change is our own life. So then people strive individually to find solutions. And I think in the end, that's just detrimental, because it's only little band-aid. So it's only certain classes that have improved their situation, but the overall situation is not so good. And I also wanted to touch upon these new mobility services that are coming about, things like Uber Eats, or we see in developing countries, these have transformed to bring not just food to your house, but to bring all manner of services. So they've become almost courier kind of services. I mean, they'll take you to the place you want to go and get your haircut, but they'll also bring a hairdresser to your house if you need to. And in some sense, that's good because it eliminates the need for travel, for women to travel. So if they need to be home with the kids, they can be home with the kids. And then whatever that dress that they want it made will come to their house instead of them having to go and pick it up. But then in some sense, these seems to have confined women even more to the domestic sphere. It's like now they don't even need to leave the house at all. So there is also that. I mean, it's not necessarily a perfect solution.
Yeah, it's sort of car culture in America and the difficulty in, you know, I live in Baltimore at the moment, and it is, most of Baltimore is a food desert. There are very few grocery stores within the city. And of course they tend to be in the sort of upper class neighborhoods. And it's really sort of isolating in these weird ways, because you're either in your domestic space in your apartment, or you're in your car. Like, you're just like in yes. these little pods all of the time. And, you know, having lived in Berlin for so long, where there are little markets everywhere and there's this constant interaction, it's really strange how we have all just decided to live this way, that American urban planning sort of created this situation, and we just think it's a inevitability that there are no alternatives to this way of being.
Yes. Well, that's the problem with urban planning, because it takes a long time to kind of settle in, new ideas settle in and become sort of enshrined in law. And then infrastructure itself is very expensive to build. So one person during her lifetime will probably only get to experience one type of city. We don't get to see a lot of urban transformation in one place during our lifetime. I mean, the only time when we see differences is if we go to another country, like you're saying, you could see differences between Baltimore and Berlin. But if you stay in Baltimore the whole time, I mean, you'll see some changes, but they're not hugely transformational. And so then people get this idea in their mind that however the city is built, that's some sort of law of nature. It's God mandated somehow, but that's not true. It just is simply the product of planning policies. And talking about feminist planning, one thing that I've been looking into is how much influence women have had into city planning as a profession, because that perhaps is the reason why cities are designed the way they're designed. And I mean, we know from planning history that even though women might have had an influence in smaller ways, the big visionaries originally were all men. You know, these men with big egos like Le Corbusier and Frank Lloyd Wright, and they pushed for certain ideas of individualism and the city with big roads and uses all segregated. They thought that would make the city better, more hygienic, more efficient, more functional. And I think that's because they were thinking from the perspective of men. That's how they were doing it. They had in mind this idea of a family where the man went to work and the woman stayed home to take care of the family. So then you just had the one commute to take care of, one commute per family. So that was perhaps okay back then. It was doable, but look at where that got us nowadays. I mean, take a city like Los Angeles. The uses are all segregated and distributed all around the city, but you no longer have just one person commuting in the household. You have two people commuting. Women need to work to be able to afford Los Angeles real estate prices, I mean, among other things. And so now it's two long commute. I mean, the amount of travel in society has just at least doubled because of that way that we've produced cities. And then the situation in less developed countries, it's probably even worse because, so here I'm based in Australia, and we have a lot of relationships with Indonesia because that's the closest country. So I'm in touch with Indonesian colleagues, and I have Indonesian students. And take a mega city like Jakarta, that's laid out similar to Los Angeles, with big roads, with uses segregated, huge travel distances between homes and jobs. And women find themselves in this situation now where they have to work because, I mean, maybe in the past they could stay home. The husband would take care of them. That was sort of the social promise of the country. You got married, you were taken care of. Well, that's no longer the case. A lot of women, even though the country is still relatively traditional, I mean, compared to, say, the United States or Australia, but still a lot of women feel that they need to work now because marriages are no longer seen as being forever. There is no guarantee that the husband will take care of you for life. So then they feel like they need to maintain a career, even though sometimes it takes people 2-3 hours to get to work. And then the other thing in those types of contexts, which is also true in the US, I mean, to a large extent, is that the government doesn't take a lot of good care of their citizens in the sense of welfare, public welfare. So then people feel like they cannot be renting a flat closer to their job because there is no tenure security whatsoever. So they might be thrown out of that apartment at any time. So then they feel the only thing to provide the only way to provide some security, financial security for themselves or their children is to buy a home. That's where people put their money, sort of transforming cash into brick and mortar, that sort of approach to wealth. So then house prices might be way too expensive closer to the inner city where more jobs are located. So then people have to buy those homes farther and farther from where they live, which means a huge commute for both the husband and the wife, you know, in a traditional family. So that's the conundrum. I mean, that's the situation women find themselves in because of the way we've laid out the city, but then also the way we've laid out our welfare system.
Yeah, and you talking about how change is slow. So then how does change begin to happen in these urban environments? How do these ideas start to get actually sort of put into play? I mean, definitely in cities, in American cities, you see some of these ideas coming up in the wealthiest neighborhoods, like where new development is happening, but it's certainly not sort of being made available for anybody sort of outside of that demographic. So how do you, as somebody who works directly in this field, how do you see these changes sort of happening, or do you not see them happening enough?
Certainly not happening enough. Change is very, very slow. And like you said, I mean, you see these small islands of improvements, say one new urbanist neighborhood over here, another one over there. New urbanism meaning, you know, the revival of traditional ideas of urbanism where you have both home and services close together in the same neighborhood. That's a concept that's been pushed since about the 1980s. But then these solutions are just little patchworks. I mean, maybe they improve the situation for just the people in that neighborhood, but they don't do a lot for the city at large. And like you're saying before, a lot of American cities now, but also cities elsewhere, they've become these non-spaces almost, where there isn't any more the traditional urbanism, the 19th century type of urbanism where you went out of the house, short walk or short bike ride or short tram ride, and you go to a place where there were lots of services, you walked around, you picked the service you needed or the restaurant you wanted to go to, but there was an opportunity to sort of browse around the city or wander. Now there is no longer that opportunity. It's more a situation where you need to know where you're going to go. You have to have a particular address, and then you leave your pod, your neighborhood, you leave it in a car, and then you go to your destination, and the space in between is almost as if doesn't exist. It disappears. So that's not a solution, creating little pods that are sort of better for people, but then no space in between. I think the solution needs to be more radical than that. I feel that as a society, Western society, but then a lot of non-Western societies, they need to embrace a different way of doing things. I mean, we need to all accept that extreme individualism will not get us places. Our cities will become worse and worse, less and less sustainable if we keep doing that. And we need to accept that to improve things, we all need to live a little bit more snug together. You know, instead of everyone having their own house with a garden, we might have to live in apartments where we share a garden. Or even if we live in individual houses, we still might have to share the garden, because by sharing that garden instead of our individual gardens, then maybe we can start sharing some responsibilities, like the childcare responsibility, or I don't know, even the cooking responsibility, the dinner cooking responsibility. And then we also need to accept that maybe not everyone should be having their individual mobility service, meaning not everyone having their individual car, which then needs to be parked, and that takes up a lot of space as well. But we might have to share mobility, just use it as a service, and give up the idea of owning our mobility, owning our own car, just rent sort of the car as a service, and then give it up. I mean, and that's still a less radical solution. I mean, the more desirable solution in the end is for more people to use public transport more often, where you have a large vehicle that kind of moves a lot of people at the same time, because it's been proven over and over, you know, theoretically, but also shown empirically that that's the most sustainable way to go.
Yeah, and it seems like the sort of this Western world's priority of individualism has created this, you know, the people that are sort of having, I think, the greatest influence on our new domesticity are the kind of Silicon Valley crowd, where we just have an app to provide these domestic services for us in a completely sort of anonymous, faceless way, right? So you can have an anonymous person bring your laundry to you, an anonymous person bring your food to you, and so on. And so while we love these things in the Western world, while at the same time complaining constantly of feeling isolated and alienated and lonely. And so reading this sort of older material feminists and this idea of the shared domestic space of the, you know, the kitchenless house, and because there's a community kitchen and there's a community garden and, you know, all these things, it totally goes against sort of, I guess, what we envision what our lives is supposed to look like, because now our lives are supposed to look like we don't have to talk to anybody we don't know or want to know. And yet I think it would immediately sort of alleviate a lot of these problems. So I guess, like, what's your sort of response to the sort of Silicon Valley version of domesticity? And do you see, do you think we're just sort of relentlessly heading in that direction, or do you think that there's sort of more opportunity for change?
So I think when it comes to Silicon Valley, the solutions that are being proposed, I think they're also sort of band-aid solutions. Overall, they might produce a situation where there's just more travel in society rather than less. So make things more efficient rather than one person leaving her house, going and running all those errands, coming back to her house. Now it's all the services coming to her house. So maybe if one ran a model, perhaps that would even increase the overall traffic congestion. I don't know. I'm not sure, because those models have not been run just yet for these domestic services. They're a new thing. But when it comes to Silicon Valley, I think they're great at creating demand for things that we didn't quite know that we needed, sort of creating this desirability. So perhaps some of these more collective solutions that I'm proposing, they should take that aspect of Silicon Valley marketing. How do they do that? How do they create demand and desire and apply to more collective kind of solutions? And that's a task more for governments to do, because those are the entities that are more concerned about the public rather than the individual. That's the role of the state, to care about the collective. However, I'll also say this, that any solutions, including collective type of solutions, they cannot be imposed. People need to want and to own them. I mean, people need to be sort of educated in the huge sustainability concerns of our era and understand That's the way to go. If you impose anything, it's simply not going to work. And I say that with full conviction because I was born in a dictatorship situation, in a communist dictatorship myself. I'm from Albania originally, and imposed collectivist solutions existed all around Eastern Europe when I was a child, and they never worked very well. I mean, because they were imposed, people rejected them in the end, and they embraced extreme individualism when ended in 1990. So at this point, we need to sort of move beyond that government's imposing things and people just caring more about what the effect of their individual choices is for society, but do that. Maybe the state could still be in a role of coordinator, but people really need to own these solutions. That's what I think.
Yeah, I do. You know, when I've written pieces about sort of collective housing for women, but also just for everybody, the secular convent, like, people really latch on to the idea and really get excited about the idea. But there's just no sort of workable, or there are very few workable options, unless you want to go like the full hippie way, like the 1970s, like, you know, off the grid, milking cows kind of stuff. But it does seem like there is a desire and a need for it, but that just isn't being met by developers who are still sort of like, you know, in profit driven mode and so on, which sort of leads me to the question of, you know, is any of this full scale possible without socialism, without socialism being in place first, without the sort of like the economic imperative driving everything behind it?
I think it is possible if people really own these solutions. I mean, it's inevitable that solutions will start at small scale first, but we're already seeing these movements now. For example, we're seeing people rejecting things like fast fashion and being more concerned about where the clothing their buys produced, or rejecting, I don't know, Starbucks coffee and going to small coffee shops that promise to sell fair trade coffee. And these things are not being imposed by the government, really. It's more consumers that are becoming more and more aware. So it comes from a place within, sort of bottom up. And perhaps the same thing will happen with urban planning kind of solutions eventually. And of course, those are more difficult to implement because urban planning involves, you know, much larger scale projects than setting up a fair trade coffee shop, of course. But I think it's possible. I mean, once there is enough demand, yes, I think we can get there.
And so what do you think are kind of first step projects in this particular way of educating people to some of these issues? You know, especially with sort of income inequality being... having such a hold on Western cities these days. And it seems like, you know, the issues like gentrification and so on feel like more urgent. And yet they're all sort of tied up together, I think, right? I mean, you can't really talk about gentrification and so on without talking about some of these issues as well. So what are some, you know, like, first steps for communities or people interested in this subject to go forward with?
Well, some solutions already exist, actually. I mean, look at senior citizen housing. A lot of those types of projects, they involve exactly what I'm talking about, these communal kind of solutions where people, maybe they still live in their individual house or unit even. Sometimes it's, you know, multi-apartment units, buildings. But there are communal restaurants, so someone else does the cooking, and then people go downstairs, they have dinner together, they socialize, maybe they do other activities before they go up to their apartment to sleep. And I think society at large doesn't know as much about these solutions, or they're never talked about as solutions for other age groups, because that's another problem in our society, that older people are sort of invisible. It's like, once you're not economically productive, you're done, and you're sort of put aside, and you're no longer important. So whatever solutions exist there for you, they're considered sort of end of life solutions. But we could take some of those end of life solutions and make them, beginning of life solutions or middle of life kind of solutions. And I mean, we know from research, the statistics all show that there are more and more single people now, people that stay single throughout their life, more or less. They live alone, and a lot of them, I'd expect that they'd like some of these solutions when they're young, not just when they're 8 years old, but when they're 40, they could go to work, and then they don't need to be cooking every night. There is some sociability aspect built in as well. So built in community in this type of projects. I mean, not just the aspect of, not having to do your laundry and your cooking being taken care of, but you can also perhaps, make friends with your neighbors, have a built-in community in your building.
Yeah, I really, whenever I read about sort of single women hotels in places like New York, I get so nostalgic. idea of not having to start over every time, just a sort of lack of reasonable furnished apartments for younger single people. That you have to own everything in your domestic space, like you have to own a bed and a couch and everything. It really creates this huge burden on young people to create these domestic spaces from scratch.
Yes, exactly. And like I said, I mean, nothing should be imposed. It's more looking at the demand that exists out there and destigmatize those types of solutions. That's all I'm saying. I mean, instead of looking at these solutions as sort of the house of spinsters or something like that, just normalize them in society. Just accept that the way we live now, maybe not everyone wants to do their individual cooking every night, and that's perfectly fine. And I mean, some people might still want to have their own kitchen and do their own cooking. Like in my case, I love cooking. I find it therapeutic, the way some people find gardening therapeutic. That's why they badly want a private garden. But a lot of people don't like those things, and they would much prefer not having to do them at all, and that should be normalized. And in those cases, it might even be the case. I mean, some architects have already proposed these kitchenless houses. In the past, for a very long time, it's been the idea that every apartment, every house needs to have an individual kitchen. But if people aren't going to use it, if they're going to offer a communal solution, then why not do that? And same thing with gardening. I mean, if you're someone who loves gardening, finds it therapeutical, finds sort of a meaning and a connection with nature through gardening, that can also happen through community gardens, so in a more communal way. Not everyone needs to have their own private patch of grass attached to the house.
Yeah, I mean, but personally, I would definitely live in a place called the House of Spinsters.
Forever Dog. This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.